to Drunk Guys Book Club.
Where books aren't just for school, book clubs aren't just for women, and beer is our escape.
I'm Nate.
I'm Mike.
And we're the Drunk Guys.
And this week we are talking about The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Tremont.
All right, but first, we have to start with a beer. And we have what is probably the perfect beer for this book.
Which is Brooklyn Brewery's New York Comic Con Brooklyn Defender IPA.
For sure.
So what makes this beer perfect for this book?
So many things. First, it's Brooklyn, and the book takes place in New York, and in fact, the main character, Sam Clay, lives in Brooklyn. You know, he starts out in Brooklyn. He doesn't end up there. But anyway, starts in Brooklyn, and it's about comic books. It's about, because Brooklyn Brewery only produces this beer for Comic-Con, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay is about comic books. Well, so it just fits really, really well.
You know, it says IPA. This is a very mild IPA.
It's not very hoppy.
If this said pale ale on the label, I would say that's a fine pale ale.
No, this is a slightly hoppy pale ale.
Yeah, but, and it's also sort of thin-bodied. It's sort of a hoppier, it seems out of balance. The hops seem a little too much for me. It smells nice. It has a nice citrus smell coming off of it. So the book is largely about comics. Cavalier, Joseph Cavalier, and Sammy Clayman are cousins. They are two young guys. At the start of the book, they're teenagers,
yeah,
like late teens.
So the book starts in, what, 1938, 1937?
Something 38. Like 38, I believe.
So Joseph Cavalier, he's Czech. His family lives in Prague. His family has, okay, and by the way, Germany has just taken over Czechoslovakia. So and he and his family are Jewish.
I believe the word that Germans use was annexed.
Right, annexed. Well, you know. Let's not get too technical.
Yeah, right.
So, Joseph and his family, they basically put all of their money into all of their resources into getting one of their children out of the country to go to America. And this is the very start of the book. They're trying to, so they get Joe out, you know, and he's done a lot of things. He talks, you know, he's learned all the stuff about escapist and about escaping things like Houdini style. He's done a bunch of things, but anyway, he's trying to get out and, He says goodbye to his family, and he really thinks, I'm never going to see my family ever again. He gets on the train, he makes it all the way to the border of Czechoslovakia, and they tell him, no, your papers are not in order because there's a new requirement we put in just this morning. Sorry, you missed it. And then he has to try and get out.
And they've done everything they can to get out.
So he, all through the book, has all of this survivor guilt that he's kind of trying to escape the whole book long.
But so he does escape.
He does escape through the help of his, like, magic teacher and, like, Houdini escape trainer teacher. What do you call that?
I don't know.
Is there a word for that kind of thing?
Mentor? I mean...
Mentor, for sure.
If that guy was performing today, he'd be a magician. Or if he was more pretentious, maybe an illusionist.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, escape artist.
Escape artist. That's the word I was looking for.
But, so... And they do it through cunning use of the golem, that has been stored in Prague for centuries, and they also want to protect the golem from the Nazis, and they want to ship that out, and Joseph hides in the coffin of that. And he gets to the United States, and he gets to Brooklyn, and he is united, I want to say reunited because he's never met him before, but
yep,
this cousin, who has lived in Brooklyn his whole life, Sammy Clayman. And Sammy is very different than Joe in that he doesn't have all these, like, cool skills, but he's really into comic books, and has ideas for writing them, and is good as ambitions to be like a boss, like organizing teams to make comic books, and realizes that Joseph is an excellent artist, and they create a comic book character here.
And so basically, Joseph arrives in Brooklyn in the middle of the night, and then the next day, I won't say it's a Saturday night or a Sunday, and then Monday morning they go see Sam's boss, who owns a, like, novelty store, or novelty, mail order novelty business, who advertises in comic books, and literally, after meeting his cousin for a whole day, walk into his office at AM and Monday and say, we want to make you a comic book. How much will you pay us?
Joe asks if he can get him a job,
mm-hmm,
and Sammy has been kind of bullshitting his mom about how much responsibility he has, and makes him sound more important at
that
job.
And then his mom
has
been relaying that to her sister in Czechoslovakia. And so that's why Joseph arrives in New York thinking he's going to have this amazing job, or he can get this amazing job.
Right. So without getting, like, too much more into plot summary, but basically they make the comic book, and it is a wildly successful comic
book. Super, super successful.
And they create this character who is fictional, you know, in the sense that he's not a real comic book character. They make reference to plenty of real comic book characters. They talk about Superman. They mention Batman. They talk about some other ones that I never really heard of, but I'm sure they're real. And they make their character called the Escapist. And he is an escape artist who is just like Joe in many ways, except that he is an all-American-looking blonde guy named Tom Mayflower.
Yeah.
Is his alter ego, and he goes around, like, you know, superheroes have that little, like, speech kind of thing describing them, you know, able to leap buildings, tall buildings in a single bound, or faster than a speeding bullet. His thing is, like, wherever the world is, people are in bondage or chains of tyranny, he will come liberate them, because he is the escapist, right? And he goes around and just beats the shit out of Nazis.
Yeah. So, Joseph, he's stuck in New York, and he's drawing these comic books, and he's making the comic book, you know, the escapist is fighting Hitler. And this is before the war has started. This is before when the United States is still on the point of trying to decide, well, are we going to fight Hitler or not? You know, and I think the invasion, you know, the beginning of World War II in 1939 is like about to start. And the United States is very much sort of in between. You know, there are certainly some people, especially the Jews of New York, who definitely don't like Hitler. And so Joseph, he draws his first cover for his first comic book, and it's the escapist punching Hitler in the face. And that is a bold thing to do at that time because America doesn't know what to think about Hitler yet. You know, they're a little bit afraid of him, but still, Germans are the biggest ethnic group in the country, and there's plenty of, you know, Nazi sympathizers.
Who we will meet in the book.
We'll meet in the book, yeah. But, you know, they don't mention Charles Lindbergh in the book, but he was definitely one of them.
Oh, sure. And Henry Ford, was he still alive? I think he was kind
probably
of...
Probably was, yeah.
I think it was Hitler had a signed picture of Ford on his desk. I wonder
To be able to get anti-Jewish literature at Ford dealerships.
I wonder what that inscription was like. Dear Adolf, keep up the good work, Henry. Have you thought of using an assembly line?
Oh, no.
I know a guy who could help you set it up. Don't worry, he's not a Jew. I wonder what that said. I don't know if that's even true. I just heard that, but I think it's funny to think about. So they set the comic book, and that's like the setup for the story, and then it's like 600 more pages of book. Because it's a huge book.
It's a huge book. And so Joseph...
I'm sorry, it is totally worth reading.
Oh yeah, definitely.
If that's not clear yet.
This is an amazing book. So anyway, Joseph, he draws, you know, so he has this feeling like, I'm helping to fight the Nazis by drawing comic books. He, like, feels like he's doing something valuable in terms of fighting Hitler, even though he also knows how futile it is, how just, you know, I'm just drawing comic books. I'm really doing anything. And so he has all these really conflicted feelings about what he's doing. At one point, he just looks for German-looking people in the street and starts punching them.
Well, because he speaks German.
Yeah.
And he'll hear people speaking in German, and then he'll go confront them. And more often than not, it means he gets his ass kicked.
Yeah.
But he feels like he's doing something by doing that. Because, you know, drawing the escapist every week or month or whenever the comic book comes out, killing a bunch of Nazis feels good. I guess it's, like, cathartic. But it actually doesn't kill any Nazis. It doesn't stop them. And, you know, at this point, the war hasn't even quite started. They're growing in strength and number and power. And we read the book with the hindsight and the knowledge of how the war ends. You know, to imagine in 1939, before September of 1939, the war, you know, officially starts, according to historians, people must not have really known. They might be like, oh, I guess this is what's happening now. This is what happens in Europe. You know, one of the big themes of the book, probably the biggest theme, is escape. I mean, obviously, very overtly, the escapist is the main character, though they have lots of other characters who are interesting. Like, there's, like, the woman one they make later on, and there's the Four Freedoms guys. They make a bunch of characters, but the escapist is their main thing.
Yeah.
So that's the big theme, and there's so many different levels or layers and types of escape that happen in the book. So we got Joe escapes from Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia.
The rest of his family dies.
Oh, spoiler.
Yeah.
I mean, just playing the odds, they're Czech Jews in World War II. Didn't really fare well. Though, you don't find that out until much later in the book, and that is really one of the main conflicts, as throughout, Joe keeps working to get his whole family, his brother.
Yeah.
His younger brother, who you see in some of the early scenes of the book when they talk about Joe's escape attempts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He tries it with his magic teacher, trains him to pick locks and hold his breath and do all these things, and he tries to escape from, he's like handcuffed or tied into a sack and thrown into the Moldau or whatever.
Yeah.
But of course it goes terribly, and that's an interesting episode. So there's like physical, literal escapes, the escape from there, and then Sammy has escapes of his own that are more sort of figurative.
Mm-hmm.
So another theme throughout the book, besides escape and just what it means to be a Jew in 1940 America, is homosexuality. Because Sammy learns, spoiler, throughout the book, that he's gay. He realizes. And then he wants to escape that. because he's not too pleased with it. This is a long time before it became, however socially acceptable it is now, certainly wasn't then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the term they use throughout the whole book is fairy,
yep.
which is probably the more polite term of the day for a gay person, a gay man. And he tries to escape by leaving New York City and moving to the suburbs. So you have escape there, too.
Well, many different ways. Well, Joseph tries to escape, like, seven different things throughout the book. He's always trying to escape and then always sort of coming back and then not realizing how to come back. Well, that's, of course, another theme of the book is what does escape really mean? Can you really escape whatever it is you're trying to escape, or will you always carry that with you no matter what happens? And what is the thing that really sets you free? Is it, and actually, a really important line from the book, love is the true golden key of the escapist.
So the escapist gets his, in the comic book, gets his powers from, like, the Society of the Golden Key.
Mm-hmm.
These secretive, you know, escape guys from around the world, and that's their signal. And that's, and, you know, he looks like a picture, a Superman kind of character, but, like, mm-hmm. the single leotard thing on, unitard thing on.
Underwear outside your pants.
Yeah, right. And then there's a logo on your chest, and it's not a big S, it's not a bat, it's a golden key. And that's his thing. And I think there's also, like, a golden key lapel or pin or something like that in the comic book, and that's where he gets his strength from. Because in the comic book, they eventually, they decide to upgrade his strength, right? So in the first two issues, he's just a guy who's good at doing escapes and throwing a punch, and then all of a sudden he's able to throw tanks and shit like that. Is it just, you know, comic books just escalate in ridiculousness? Well, how is, I mean, love is an interesting thing in this book. There are relationships between characters that are get very complicated.
Yeah.
So, what do you mean?
Well, okay, let's just talk about one of those then. So, Joe, because we've talked much more about Joe than Sam, but Joe, at a party, oh no, actually, first he meets Rosa when he uses his like, escapist skills to actually break into an apartment so that he and Sam can actually, like, have a place to draw their first comic book so that they can show it. And inside is a naked Rosa who flees in terror, and everyone else thinks it's really funny. And then months later, Joe ends up going to a party where he saves Salvador Dali's life, and it happens, that really happens in the book, yeah. And then he that happens to be at Rosa's house, because Rosa's father is some rich New York dude who has parties like that involve Salvador Dali in a diver's outfit.
No,
he was just in the diver's outfit.
He's in the suit, and he's got the pump going, so yeah. You can't actually hear, like, anything, and nobody's in the room with him.
Like the old-timey, like, diving suit.
Yeah, like the brass round helmet thing.
Mm-hmm.
And something happens where the suit, he can't get the helmet off.
It malfunctions, he's not getting any air, he can't get the helmet off, and it's Joseph that manages to finally, like, unscrew the thing and saves him. And then Rosa is like, oh, I trained to be a nurse for a day.
He hurts his hand.
Yeah, he hurts his hand, Frank Darrell, let me help you. Anyway, so that's how they, like, really meet. And then they fall in love and all this stuff, but he also then, later in the book, has to escape that. But that's because of also other really big events that we haven't described yet.
He doesn't have to escape it.
But he feels, so his whole thing is he's always trying to escape. I mean, he wasn't necessarily trying to escape Rosa exactly, but he was trying to, when something really bad happens to him, he just needs to get away. He just, like, that's his impulse, is just to get away when there's some kind of really big trouble. But the very end of the book, and we're jumping ahead a bit, but the very end of the book is about him realizing escape isn't what he really thought it was. It's not really, what really set him free was coming back, was coming home, is what made him actually a complete person again. Was actually returning, not escaping. And so returning to Rosa at the very end. The whole shitload of stuff happens in between. I mean, we haven't even we're not even close to talking about
the
entirety of World War II. We haven't even begun talking about Antarctica.
Well, that's one of the many places he escapes to.
Yeah.
So we've already ruined it that his family dies. Rosa works for an agency that tries to help Jewish refugees relocate to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And they are working specifically to get Joseph's brother over.
Sort of a whole, like, steamer ship full of, like, of all of just children, Jewish children, in order to, from Europe, to bring them to the United States.
And one of the, as the boys, as Cavalier and Clay, they, you know, they're getting kind of ripped off in their business deals with the comic book, but they're still actually making a ton of money.
Yeah.
And Joe,
because they're 20 years old, so they, for them, this is the first real money they've ever had.
But they're making a lot of money. They're making, you know, hundreds of dollars a week,
mm-hmm.
in a time when that's actually quite a comfortable living, and Joe is saving it, and he's using that money to bribe his parents and his brother over to the States to pay whoever he has to do, grease whatever mm-hmm. wheels, and he uses the connection with Rosa. He'll finance the trip for his brother, and then he said, I'll pay for two kids, and eventually it's like 15 kids he's paying for when the ship sets sail. But, of course, the ship is sunk by a
so
U-boat.
So first, actually, the ship can't, they won't let anyone into the United States. Like, the ship is, like, sailing across. When this really happened, where a ship full of Jewish refugees sailed from Europe and made it all the way to the United States, and the United States would not let them in because they were Jewish. They even went to Cuba. Cuba wouldn't let them in.
Well, is it because they were Jewish or because there was something about diplomacy with other countries? Or I don't think it was...
I think it was because they were Jewish.
We have some Jews in the United States.
Yeah, but the Immigration Service of 1939.
Well, this was still with the quotas of the 1924 Immigration Bill.
That definitely had something to do with it.
Well,
sure,
the Quota Act basically limited. It was passed in the 20s, 1924, I think, and it went back to the percentage of, you know, whatever country we're talking about, the percentage of them, of those people who lived in the United States, according to the 1890 census, that's how many
could
come in each year. So whatever number they settle on, like, oh, so like Poles were like net less than 1% of the population in 1890. If you remember your history classes, 1890s is when you start getting the Ellis Island immigration, and that's when you get all the Southern Europeans and the Eastern Europeans and the... the undesirable Europeans and also people from Asia start coming over in larger numbers, and in the Middle East even, and India. I said Asia, but like China and India are like the two ones. Well, none of them were really here in large numbers in 1897. They're like, oh, fuck that. Let's only you know, whatever percentage of them that were here in 1890 can continue to go over. And that would actually be in place until President Johnson signed a new immigration bill in like 1965. So... that might have something to do with it. Not that it excuses the behavior, but like
these are desperate people escaping like the most desperate circumstances.
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying that might have been part of it. I just think it might have just been convenient to cite that bill, and I'm sure at least some person in the chain of making that decision was anti-Semitic. I wouldn't be surprised if they were. But the law was just so flawed and racist at the time that.
So anyway,
it's easy to do.
So Joseph gets his brother onto a boat, onto the ship, and they, like, first they're quarantined because somebody had measles or had something, and
yeah,
then they try to make it back to the United States, and then the ship is sunk by a U-boat.
Yep.
That's really, this is kind of like the climax of the whole novel, really.
Well, and it's not even that this, like, so the U-boat tells them, we're going to sink your ship, everyone gets on lifeboats, they sink the ship, and then there's a storm.
Yeah, it's...
So, like...
there's just no way. Nobody survives.
Everybody does. And this is about just shy of 2/3 through the book. This big climactic thing. Because the whole time, you're, like, waiting for this. And all the characters are making plans and preparing for when Thomas, Joseph's brother, comes to the States. And they don't. They just make it. And also, along the way, Joseph's father's died. So now... and he knows about this, too.
Yeah.
So his brother died. His father's dead. His brother's killed. And... He escapes. He runs away again.
Yeah.
And this time he joins the Navy.
Yeah, so literally, and that happens on December 6th, 1941, because the next day's papers... no, December 7th, because the next day's papers are Pearl Harbor just happened, and then the next day after that is United States declares war on Germany and Japan, and so Joseph immediately joins the Navy. Wait, the Navy?
Navy.
Joins the Navy, because he wants to go kill some Nazis.
But
Rosa... had just found out the day before that she was pregnant and hadn't told him the week before and had not told Joseph that she was pregnant yet. So she was waiting to tell him. Oh my gosh, she was going to tell him, literally waiting him for to arrive back at their apartment to tell him when he gets the news, and so he never makes it back.
Yep, but his plan is to join the Navy, partially to escape from this, but he's trying to rush headlong into the conflict he has not been able to participate in. He's been drawing pictures of killing Nazis, but now he wants to do it. And unfortunately, he is sent to an obscure outpost in Antarctica.
You know, I'm sure this is the kind of thing that happens to a lot of people who join the military, is they think they're going to be on SEAL Team 6 and do, like, the most amazing things, but instead they get the weirdest job in the weirdest place that they had no interest in doing in the first place. And so what Joseph ends up doing is he's the radio man on the Navy's Antarctic post, an Antarctic, like, station that does things like monitor the weather and monitors the radio communications of the German subs in the South Atlantic. So they're in Antarctica. So suddenly we've got this, like, big major thing that happens to the book, and then we go, oh, Now we're just in Antarctica for a while.
Right. Well, I mean, it's kind of cut up. There's other, because we mm-hmm. have stuff happening to
there's,
Sam.
There's stuff happening to Sam, too, that we barely talked about, but...
Right. So he goes there, and then there's a whole bunch of shit that happens there, and he literally has to escape from there in a couple of different ways,
mm-hmm.
because there's, like, a faulty fireplace thing that everybody dies of carbon monoxide poisoning, except for him and one other guy.
And one other dude. So the pilot, the guy who's, like, their pilot, their Arctic pilot, is sleeping outside in the hangar, so he doesn't die either, so it's just him and one other dude.
And they have to escape from Antarctica.
And then they basically endure the whole Antarctic winter, which is our summer. But they're winter, and it's just the two of them. One thing that really reminded me that I ended up thinking about when I read this was actually the part of Packing for Mars when Mary Roach was talking about how annoyed people get with each other after just no... When you're in incredibly close quarters with somebody, like in the size of, you know, in a space capsule, the size of a Volkswagen for 2 weeks, you know, that even the people you would normally really, really like in person just completely annoy you. And so that sort of isolation in Antarctica must have been really terrible. And it's dark. It's completely dark 24 hours a day. So that was also, you know, the joke is that if everybody... It's not a question of if you'll go crazy. It's just a question of how much. spending the winter in Antarctica. So he and the pilot decide... So, okay, Joseph, he's a radio guy. He just spends all day listening to the different bands, trying to pick up the intercepts, trying to pick up the communications of the German subs, the German U-boats, and he manages to figure out that there is another station on Antarctica, and it's manned by Nazis. Except there was a crazy, like, murder-suicide, and now there's only one dude there. there's one Nazi, like, weather scientist. It's 1,000 miles on the other side of Antarctica, and so he and the pilot... Because they kind of have nothing else to do without even radioing what their plans are. They just get the airplane ready and they fly over to kill that guy. Then the pilot has appendicitis and dies in the flight. Like, they're, like, before they even make it. They crash, like, just a couple miles away from the Nazi station. Joseph gets out and manages to walk all the way to the station. And then the one, you know, Nazi dude who's left shoots Joseph in the arm. And then immediately dies because he's been hopped up on methamphetamines for like weeks, you know, and has nothing. He literally shits his pants and then immediately dies. And that is Joseph's one real interaction with real German Nazis.
Not as satisfying as blowing up the German tank to watch a guy shit his pants and die. Yeah. Well, actually, it's a different kind of satisfaction. It's a little more humiliating.
Joseph says, if it said later, it felt terrible. I was so lonely. And this is one person who could completely relate to my situation because the Nazi dude also just spent the winter in Antarctica totally by himself. And he was then really, really lonely because then Joseph was entirely alone on the entire continent of Antarctica.
It's a little
dramatic.
About
escape. Talk about escape, but that definitely didn't make him feel better.
No, but it is a little, that whole scene, that section of the book is a little overly dramatic.
Yeah.
A bit extreme.
It's a bit like a comic book.
Well, yeah. So that's something I thought about. The title of the book, right? The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay sounds like a comic book. And there are many elements of the characters' behaviors that are comic book-like.
Mm-hmm.
So this sort of man against nature and these unsurvivable odds, and of course Joseph lives, is one thing. But there's also, you backtrack, Joseph has all these skills that are kind of comic book-like. Right, so the escapist can break through chains and all that bullshit. Joseph is trained at lockpicking and escaping from handcuffs, and he uses this several times throughout the book. You know, when there's like the bomb threat in the building and he handcuffs himself to the desk so they can't take him out, he like uses his like magic trick skills to steal the handcuffs from a police officer and do this. He is also sort of acrobatic in his strength when he breaks into that apartment in the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just climb up, he like gymnastically does it. He like, gets onto a railing and like spins
does
around
a backflip
and, yeah.
up the ladder or something like that
with like a cigarette in his mouth. Like he does it, you know, with panache, and so he has like the skills of a more human like superhero character. And his Sammy, who we just keep not talking about, has the other element in that, since Sammy is, I guess, closeted homosexual, right? I mean, he really is not openly gay until throughout most of the book. He has the secret identity.
He does,
and they have this superhero kind of like life. And also, you know, also kind of like superheroes is like the fact that everything kind of works out for them in certain ways too. They have a first comic book becomes an instant huge success and is this famous thing. Like, there's some element of the, like, of extreme luck there or something. I don't know. That just, I mean, it fits. It feels okay in the book, but there's that element there too that I thought was a little, like, hyperbole comic booky.
You know what else is really lucky? What's that? We have more beer.
We do have more beer.
Which we should talk about.
Which, well...
And I definitely need some more beer.
You brought this book, this beer.
All right. Well, this is called Hop Mana from the Schmaltz... Was it? So, by the Schmaltz Company, Schmaltz Brewing Company, and it's called Hebrew, the Chosen Beer.
Well, Hebrew is the, like, the brand, and Hop Mana is the beer.
Just the name of the beer. So, what's right. The Schmaltz?
So, that's, like, the... I guess the corporation name or something like that.
The corporate overlords.
Yeah.
Of the Hebrews.
I believe that was the Egyptians for a while. the pharaohs.
Yeah, so anyway, so this is Hebrew. So it's perfect for this book.
Because, you know, I love Hebrew, the beer, because, I mean, not that I have a problem with the Hebrew people, but they really lean into the joke. I mean, Hebrew, it's the chosen beer. And their beers are constantly referencing stuff from Judaism. Not that I fucking know anything about it as a goy, but, I mean, let's see. There's, like, a whole little story on here. In the book of Exodus, right? Like, it starts, like...
This is the beer label.
This is the beer label.
In the book of Exodus.
Well, because manna is what the Jews survived on for the 40 years they wandered in the desert. The manna from heaven came down to sustain them. I don't know if I'd last 40 years in the desert on this beer, but...
This is a weird story.
They also will do things where... Because numerology is important, at least in some sort of, I guess, more like Kabbalistic forms of Judaism or sects or whatever, or count the letters of things or count the position of that letter in the alphabet and add up these things to get their numbers.
Yeah, that's where the 666 comes from.
Right, though I think that's like a mathematical error. I think it's not actually 666. I think it's like 616 or something.
I know where that story comes from. It's not even worth talking about.
I think it's, podcast. I mean, it's
although there is an episode of Radiolab about that specific issue. We'll put it in the show notes.
So if you've listened to every episode of our podcast and you're still hungry for your podcasts, go check out Radiolab. You may have heard of it.
But they're almost as famous as we are.
Almost. Less beer then.
Yeah.
Probably less jokes about me masturbating or wiping my ass with corduroy or something. You know, everyone's got, you know, growth areas. So, and I'm not
they're
even going to make...
They're clearly deficient.
They are. And I'm not even going to make the penis growth area joke. I'm going to let that slide. I'm going to let it go. It's going to go. But this is the point about the Hebrew beer, is they'll have a beer and, like, all the... They'll be like, oh, there are... You know, this beer is 10% alcohol because... And then they'll, like, list all the different shit in the Old Testament or the Torah that's 10. Like, there are 10 commandments. There were 10 plagues of the Moses. There were... And they'll just go on and on. And it's kind of funny. I don't think it's very, like, tongue-in-cheek. I think it's with love or, you know, mm-hmm. affection. And I know the founder of the company is a Jewish guy. Like, he's not doing it to insult the people. It's just
trying to be funny.
Just trying to be funny. And in fact, I have their book. I still haven't read it, but a while ago I picked up a whole bunch of beer books and just been slowly working my way through one. And the one about founding of Hebrew is called Craft Beer Bar Mitzvah. So they just lean into it.
Cool.
Sometimes it's really ridiculous. They have their anniversary beer is Jubilation, spelt like you would imagine.
Yep.
Or they'll make beers with rye or stuff like cashing in on or like figs or things that are common of like Jewish tradition. So, what do you think of this beer? What are we talking about?
I think it's good. I like it. It's definitely a hoppier IPA than the Brooklyn Defender.
It is. It's also it's actually just about the same strength. And we said Brooklyn Defender, I think, is 6.7 ABV, and this is 6.8. It tells you the hop. This is dry hopped with three different types of hops: it's Centennial, Cascade, and Citra hops. So, you know what dry hopping is?
Nope.
Oh, it's sort of like dry humping, except you do it to beer. You take so when they brew beer during the boiling process of making the beer itself, you put hops in there, and the hops boil, and the oils and all that kind of shit comes down. Depending on when you put those hops in the boil, which typically is about an hour or so. If you put them in the very beginning, you get all the bitterness out of the hop, and you don't really get the smell. If you put them at the end, you get the smell, but not so much of the bitterness. So most beers kind of balance it out. But dry hopping is when, like, the beer's already brewed, it's already boiled, it's already fermented, and then you throw some more hops in, and you just get a very, very pungent hop smell off of it. So you get more and more this hop on the nose, as you say. It's dry hopping with these different hops. This is a similar kind of issue we had with packing for Mars, right? You tell me you have all these different ingredients. And this is a little better because Packing for Mars had four types of hops. This tells me the names. I don't know what the fuck a Centennial hop or a Cascade hop or a Citra hop really tastes like or smells like. Mm-hmm. I guess if I make more and more beer, I'll learn more about the ingredients. And some beers, you can learn, you know, from trying it. But this information doesn't mean a whole lot to me. It's like when, you know, you buy some sort of product and they just list it and something in it that you don't know what it is. Like, that sounds exotic. That sounds cool. Like if I buy a guitar, like it's made with Bubinga. I'm like, oh, well, what the fuck does that mean?
That's awesome.
Yeah, I guess, right? That's a wood, right?
Yeah.
Like, so these are hops. But it's a good beer. I think it is more, there's like a lasting bitterness after it.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of lingers on your tongue. It's nice. It's a nice IPA. And I think available all the time. You can get a lot of different Hebrew beers around. Maybe that's just in New York. Kind of. Maybe if you live in a place with, like if you leave the city limits or where there's fewer of the chosen people, they're like, no, we don't carry that. But I believe it's also a kosher beer, which is really funny. I don't even know beer could be kosher. I don't know.
Or not kosher.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, bacon? Unless, I mean, I assume if you put bacon in it, it's not kosher anymore.
That definitely would unkosher the beer or any other thing you're making.
But is regular beer not kosher?
From my extremely limited, virtually made up understanding of what kosher means, I think there's some sort of blessing involved from a rabbi and observation of process, like certainly in accordance with whatever, you know, Old Testament rules there are, or Talmudic, or whatever.
So don't put shellfish in it either.
No shellfish, can't mix it with cheese and meat, like no meat and dairy. Has to marry a doctor. I don't really know how beer could, it's like boiling soup, is like essentially how you make beer. I don't know how that becomes, unless it's masa ball soup, I don't know how it becomes kosher, but whatever. So it's a great beer. I like this better than the Brooklyn Defender, I have to say.
Yeah, me too.
And probably just because it actually tastes like an IPA.
It does taste like an IPA.
The Brooklyn Defender sounded like it was like just trying to defend me from IPAs. It's like, stand back. Your palate is not ready. Have some of this windy IPA. This is pretty substantial. I'm going to open this other bottle of it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Can't fucking waste it. Wander around in the desert for 40 years.
For 40 minutes while we discuss Cavalier and Clay. While we discuss escapism in Cavalier and Clay.
Well, since we're talking about the chosen beer here, let's go back to the golem, because that's the thing. I mean, this is the second time I've read this book. You read it twice too, right?
Yep. Actually, three times.
Wow, all right. Good for you. All
right. I win, right?
Oh, you want to go? Okay. Did you read it, or did you listen to it?
Close enough.
Well, you know what? They're trying to make a movie out of this.
Really?
The rights were... So this book came out in, 2000? It won the Pulitzer for fiction, and it is considered Mike Chabon's best book. I've read a few of his... Have you read anything else of his?
No, I read Telegraph Avenue and Moonglow.
Okay, so those are two I haven't read, but I've read The Final Solution, which is not what you think, and The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is what you think. And I really liked them. What did you think of the other ones?
I really liked them, too.
How do they compare to this, though?
Well, okay, Moonglow, which is the previous one that I just read. I mean, that only came out about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty new. So that's a little bit actually more nonfiction, even though it's more of a memoir, but it's a memoir of his grandfather's life, and it's told. I mean, he's still a novelist, so it's still told like a novel, but it is also a little bit different. I really liked it, and there's, you know, a lot of really interesting things happened to his grandfather, including hunting Wernher von Braun in Europe after D-Day.
I mean, you're going to have to tell me who the fuck that
is. So Wernher von Braun was the head of the Nazi rocket program that created the V-1 rockets and the V-2 rockets, who then, after the war, instead of, you know, being captured by the Russians, was captured by the Americans, and then became one of the top guys, top rocket scientists in NASA, and designed a bunch of the Gemini and Apollo rockets that in this American space program. Anyway, there's a lot of really good stuff in that book. We should do...
The parallels with packing for Mars continue.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, we should definitely do Moonglow on the podcast, because I really, really liked it.
I actually have a beer called Moonglow.
Right. So I saw that in the store. You stole that. You bought it before I could.
I know this is a book.
I'm just going to buy it.
I'll buy it. If, worst case scenario, I have to drink this beer.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'll take one for the team. I mean, I like his style. But this is like his big work.
This is definitely the most famous.
Now, it's also... quite literally his, I think, biggest work. It's a huge book, and it has so many different things, and it has themes that he revisits often, like Jewish identity, sexuality, and he likes to do sort of historical things, like taking place,
or digging into like a specific thing. In this book, it was comic books.
Right.
In Telegraph Avenue, it was literally like jazz. It was like Jazz Records. Not just jazz, it's Jazz Records. And in Moonglow, it's like the space program.
So it's dry hopped with these different beers, right? It's dry hopped with these different hops. This is a similar kind of issue we had with packing for Mars, right? You tell me you have all these different ingredients. And this is a little better because packing for Mars just had four types of hops. This tells me the names. I don't know what the fuck a Centennial hop or a Cascade hop or a Citra hop really tastes like or smells like. Mm-hmm. I guess if I, you know, as I make more and more beer, I'll learn more about the ingredients. And some beers, you can learn, you know, from trying it. But this information doesn't mean a whole lot to me. It's like when, you know, you buy some sort of product and they just list in something in it that you don't know what it is. Like, that sounds exotic. That sounds cool. Like if I buy a guitar, like it's made with Bubinga. I'm like, oh, well, what the fuck does that mean?
That's awesome.
Yeah, I guess, right? That's a wood, right?
Yeah.
Like, so these are hops. But it's a good beer. I think it is more, there's like a lasting bitterness after it.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of lingers on your tongue. It's nice. It's a nice IPA. It is, and I think available all the time. You can get a lot of different Hebrew beers around. Maybe that's just in New York, kind of. If you live in a place with, like, if you leave the city limits or where there's fewer of the chosen people, they're like, no, we don't carry that. But I believe it's also a kosher beer, which is really funny. I don't even know beer could be kosher. I don't know.
Or not kosher.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, bacon? I assume if you put bacon in it, it's not kosher anymore.
That definitely would unkosher the beer or any other thing you're making.
But is regular beer not kosher?
From my extremely limited, virtually made up understanding of what kosher means, I think there's some sort of blessing involved from a rabbi and observation of process, like certainly in accordance with whatever, you know, Old Testament rules there are, or Talmudic or whatever.
So don't put shellfish in it either.
No shellfish, can't mix it with cheese and meat, like no meat and dairy, has to marry a doctor. I don't really know how beer could, it's like boiling soup, is like essentially how you make beer. I don't know how that becomes, unless it's matzo ball soup, I don't know how it becomes kosher, but whatever. So, it's a great beer. I like this better than the Brooklyn Defender, I have to say.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
And probably just because it actually tastes like an IPA.
It does taste like an IPA.
But the Brooklyn Defender sounded like it was like just trying to defend me from IPAs. It's like, stand back, your palate is not ready. Have some of this Wimpy IPA. This is pretty substantial. I'm going to open this. Let's open this other bottle of it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Can't fucking waste it. Wander around in the desert for 40 years. So,
for 40 minutes while we discuss Cavalier and Clay. While we discuss escapism in Cavalier and Clay.
Well, since we're talking about the chosen beer here, let's go back to the golem. Because that's the thing. I mean, this is the second time I read this book. You read it twice too, right?
Yep. Actually, three times.
Well, all right. Good for you. All
right. I win. Right?
Oh, you want to go? Okay. Did you read it or did you listen to it?
Close enough.
So, you know what? They're trying to make a movie out of this.
Really?
The rights were. So, this book came out in, what, 2000? Hmm. It won the Pulitzer for fiction, and it is considered Michael Chabon's best book. I've read a few of his. Have you read anything else of his?
No, I read Telegraph Avenue and Moonglow.
Okay, so those are two I haven't read, but I've read The Final Solution, which is not what you think, and The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is what you think, and I really liked them. What did you think of the other ones?
I really liked them too.
How do they compare to this, though?
Well, okay, Moonglow, which is the previous one that I just read. I mean, that only came out about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty new, so that's a little bit actually more nonfiction, even though it's more of a memoir, but it's a memoir of his grandfather's life. And it's told, I mean, he's still a novelist, so it's still told like a novel, but it is also a little bit different. I really liked it, and there's, you know, a lot of really interesting things happened to his grandfather, including hunting Wernher von Braun in Europe after D-Day. And,
I mean, you don't have to tell me who the fuck that
is. So Wernher von Braun was the head of the Nazi rocket program that created the V1 rockets and the V2 rockets, who then, after the war, instead of, you know, being captured by the Russians, was captured by the Americans, and then became one of the top guys, top rocket scientists in NASA, and designed a bunch of the Gemini and Apollo rockets that in this American space program. Meanwhile, anyway, there's a lot of really good stuff in that book. We should do...
The parallels with Packing for Mars continue.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Anyway, we should definitely do Moonglow on the podcast, because I really, really liked it.
I actually have a beer called Moonglow.
Right, so I saw that in the store. You stole that. You bought it before I could.
Like, I know this is a book.
I'm just going to buy it.
I'll buy it. If worst case scenario, I have to drink this beer.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'll take one for the team. So, I mean, I like his style. But this is, like, his big work.
This is definitely the most famous.
Now, it's also quite literally his, I think, biggest work. It's a huge book. And it has so many different things. And it has themes that he revisits often, like Jewish identity, sexuality. And he likes to do sort of historical things, like taking place,
or digging into, like, a specific thing. In this book, it was comic books. Right. In Telegraph Avenue, it was literally like jazz. It was like jazz records. Not just jazz, it's jazz records. And in Moonglow, it's like the space program. It's astronomy and the space program.
Well, this also has a ton of shit about magic and escapism.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of stuff. And there's a crazy amount of research he must have done.
Yeah.
For the details. Not that I fact-checked. It's not like Mad Men, where they, like, make sure that brand of, you know, ashtray was available in 1964 before they put it in an episode of the show. This, you know, he's mentioning all these actual historical figures and making them do things, obviously, that are somewhat fictional or entirely fictional, but they have to kind of match their character and match what New York City was like, or mm-hmm. wherever the heck we're talking about was like at that time. So there's a ton of different research he must have done, and clearly he likes to do that for his books. And, you know, yeah. Actually, you know what? I also read a short story collection of his, Werewolves in Their Youth, which had some really cool stories in it. You could see, though, in this, I'm reading about him at some point. I read, like, some of his influences were, who's the guy that wrote the book that never ends? That French guy, Proust?
I was going to say Victor Hugo, but...
Nah, fuck that guy. It's
also a really fucking long book.
It is, but it's no Remembrance of Things Past, where it's 3,000 pages of
Jesus
eating a cookie, apparently, right?
That's 2.5 Infinite Jests.
Fuck. So, Infinite Jest is finite, you're saying?
Apparently.
Right.
Just like, I don't want to even say it.
Well, the link there, I've read like 4 pages of Remembrance of Things Past, and I was like, there's like 3,000 more of this? No, thank you. Though, you know what? If we do Infinite Jest, I'll read that next. Gauntlet Throne. He has these long sentences, very complicated sentences, with lots of sort of like clauses that they're not run-ons. I'm sure it's all grammatically sound, but there are no simple sentences.
English teachers.
Yeah. Dicks. There are no, you know, and then he went to the store period. He wanted an apple period. He bought an apple. No, it's going to be like walking into the store, comma, abound with the opportunity to purchase different apples, including Gala, Macintosh, Granny Smiths, and a new type of apple that looked like it came from Japan, comma. He pondered this and the meaningfulness of the apple down to the very core of the problem. Like, it'll just keep going, going, going to say things. And in fact, every like 15 to 30 pages, there'll be one paragraph that just ends with a giant list of shit. Where like, and then he went into the office and saw the item he was looking for on the desk, surrounded by... blah, 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 blah. He just lists
three pens, a notebook,
yeah,
a crumpled piece of paper, a spot of blood. No, I'm just making this up.
But it's kind of like that. And you're like, is this... am I supposed to be paying attention to that? Like, do I need to remember this? Is it like... I mean, it's not a detective story where you... and that was the clue.
Mm-hmm.
But there's tons of data. And I guess it's effective at you know, painting the picture of letting you see the scene. But after a while, you're like, maybe you could have cut a few words here. I don't know. I mean, I still really loved it. And the writing, and one of the things, going back to episode one, what makes a great book is what is the quality of the writing. And I don't think there's... I think the quality of the writing in this week's...
yep, top notch.
Unassailable.
Mm-hmm.
So I like his stuff. He has these similar themes, and, you know, I'm pretty sure, I'm certain he is Jewish, so Judaism is some kind of plays in the majority of the stuff of his writing. The golem is this Jewish entity, which I really don't know much about. What we learn from the book is that it's a clay, like, statue of a man.
Mm-hmm. Like man-sized.
Well, larger than man. It's like the proportions of a man, but it's like a giant.
Yeah, yeah. A giant man-sized thing made out of clay from mud, like clay mud, from the Moldau in Prague.
And whatever rabbi, I forget his name, he created it, and he writes, you know, some special thing on the creature's head, and it comes to life, and it does stuff for him. But unlike, it's not like a slave, it's there to sort of protect the Jews, and that's why they want to protect the golem in the beginning of the book. They want to ship it out of
Czechoslovakia.
And it, as we mentioned, that aids in Joseph's escape. Well, if we keep going, you know, down the English teacher rabbit hole here of the superhero behaviors, the golem is like a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Jewish superhero, which is not, you know, the most exciting title for a superhero. Like, I'm trying to think of a good, not offensive Jewish superhero name.
Hold on. Should I pause it?
Pause it. Oh, come on, let me think of something. Like something like Aquamanora or Shabbat Man, like some sort of thing, you know, or you know, he's so strong, no locks can hold him because he'll eat them. yeah, that's a thinker. But
takes a minute, yeah.
But it is a protector of the Jewish people, which is what superheroes are. They're protectors, right? And actually, this theory is supported in the first scene. Joseph draws a superhero, a comic book scene. What does he draw?
So Joseph and Sam, they show up at Sam's, at Sheldon Annapol's office saying, we want to draw you a superhero, while Joseph is like taking a piece of paper, I'm just drawing something right now. I'm just drawing it and we're going to show it to you in like 5 minutes. And he draws the golem. Like to him, the golem is the protector, is the superhero that he has in his mind.
Right, so there's that is the kind of like the link between the Jewish thing and the superhero thing. So,
pause it, right?
You pause it. So that kind of is the link between the Jewish strand of the plot and the superhero strand of the plot, right? The golem is the Jewish superhero.
I see.
And I mean, I think that's a fair assessment. And now I don't really know what to make of this, but conspiracy theory level, you know, Illuminati.
Dan Brown.
Oh, yeah. Dan Brown. Dan Brown's next book. The golem is the clay automaton thing that's made by the rabbi. Sammy's last name is Clayman. Clayman. I don't know what to make of that. That cannot be a fucking coincidence.
It can't. Not in a book this intentional.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what to make of it, except that the golem represents something related to Sammy as well. Maybe it has something to do with transformation, because by the end of the book, the golem has transformed. The golem is... They find it eventually. I mean, there's like this whole scene in the beginning of the book where they try to find the golem.
Yeah.
And they know it's in... They have to find this building, and they have to, like, this elaborate con.
Put the things in the window.
Yeah. It was kind of cool. As they're in the, you know, like the Czech ghetto where all the people have been forced in, mm-hmm. and the people protecting it, the golem gets its way to, makes its way to, you know, wherever they are in Long Island by the end of the book. Or are they in New Jersey at that point?
No, Long Island.
They're in Long Island, right?
Yeah.
So they get all the way to there, and it's, unfortunately, it's not there anymore. It's disintegrated. It's just dust.
So this random giant box ends up in Sam and Rosa's house. It's shipped to them. It has stickers like it's been through a million different countries, and it ends up back with Joseph at the very end of the book. We didn't even talk about why all that other stuff happened, but anyway. And the golem, this is the box that Joseph was hiding in to escape the Nazis, to escape Czechoslovakia in 1938. And this is like 1956. And this box ends up back in his house, but it's the golem, except it's just turned to dust. It's completely dried out. It's just a box of dust.
One thing I can think of is that the golem and the box had to escape as well.
Yeah.
And the thing that Joseph learns at the end is that you can't escape, or it's not what you want it to be. Well, like, the golem escaped, and it, in the process...
Didn't survive.
It didn't survive. It was destroyed. So the, you know, escape is not necessarily a solution. It's the only thing I could think... I wasn't sure what to make of that. That's the best I can come up with. Probably not very good, but it has something... Clearly has something to do with escape. It has to do with transformation.
Mm-hmm.
But transforming into a pile of shittiness is not great. Like, the golem is it loses all of its power. But that also, you know, has something to do with it.
It's also that, you know, it actually, right in the beginning of the book, when they're talking about the golem, that it was made from the mud of the Moldau. And so once it was transported away from the Moldau, from the river, and it's no longer, like, so humid anymore, something like... I'm trying to gather my thoughts here. I've already had too much beer. Uh-oh. This is going to be bad.
Well,
so anyway, you can't... Something about you can't really survive escaping. So you can physically escape, but... Oh, my God. Sorry. Well, maybe I had it for a second.
Well, maybe, here, let me say something stupid so you'll think of something funny. Maybe it has something to do with, like, the golem could not survive outside of the place where it was created. And this is something about the transformation that has to take place for Joe as he moves.
Or something is lost when you try and escape. That your something about your person, your essence, your soul, your whatever, doesn't really survive if you just try and leave and try and escape. Because the golem escaped, but it didn't actually escape because it didn't survive. Because it just totally turned to dust. Like, once it escaped its original home, once it left its original home, it just disintegrated. Once it escaped its original, you know, the people who created it, it just turned to dust. There's something in there.
I think so.
I almost formed this thought completely, but not totally.
I'm with you. Makes sense to me. I didn't have a very good theory of what it was. Besides the golems being this badass superhero character. Mm-hmm. And is the first superhero of the Jews because they didn't accept Jesus as one. but yeah, or... Well, maybe David. I mean, David did some superhero kind of stuff.
No, they're
killing a giant. Sure.
Well, I mean, Moses had to have been kind of a superhero.
Kind of, right? You know, let my people go, Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what to make of the golem, but it has to be important, right? It's not just thrown in there for fun. Everything, as you said, everything's intentional in the book. I don't know. Maybe we need to drink either fewer beers or more beers to understand it. But we're out of beers for this one. Anything else you want to say about this book?
I mean, there are a million other things we could say about what happens.
It's a big book.
It's a big book. Everyone should definitely read it because it's awesome.
It really is enjoyable. And I reread very few things. I really don't like to reread things because there's just so many things I haven't read that I would rather read for the first time instead. I feel like I'm wasting time by reading something twice. This book I've read twice. And, you know, separated by about 3 years, 4 years maybe. And I remember the gist of it. There was nothing in the plot that surprised me, but I loved it. Every page of it. Even the talking about being in Antarctica, patching your plane up with dog skin. Like, even that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is awesome. Everything about it was fun to read for me. So, it definitely bears reading at least once. If you have 15 hours of reading time ahead of you.
Tell us what you thought. Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com or
follow us on Twitter @drunkguysbc, as in book club.
So tune in next week when we read Harry Potter Part 2, The Chamber of Secrets by J.K. Rowling.
See you then.